Professor Maury, Miss Main, ladies and gentlemen, I think that everyone who introduces a speaker has to feel that he's fair game for a rebuttal. And if the doctor has to bury his mistakes, I think that that cannot be very well denied. But I should like to quote another proverb, which puts a little different emphasis on it. Has to do with the doctor's wives. The doctor's wives can be well for nothing. The preacher's wives can only be good for nothing. Mr. Engels wrote me and asked if I had any objection to having the remarks which I have to present today being recorded on a wire recorder, and I presume that that's what this machine in front of me is. I see a box down at the end. I sometimes mistrust those things simply because of their fidelity. They leave nothing to chance, and they are not nearly so generous as the human ear and the human mind, which, having detected flaws, forgets them and perhaps remembers only the good things. This remembers every detail. I'm reminded of a story I heard recently from a professional colleague who was telling me about a psychiatrist. Psychiatrists these days are particularly busy. The public has become convinced that they have something to offer, and they load up their appointment schedules to the utmost. He's casting about for ways to save himself some time in his busy schedule, and he hit on the idea that perhaps he could get some of these long hour interviews recorded on a tape recorder and then take them home and listen to them at his leisure in the evening. So he tried it, and it worked out reasonably well. One day afternoon, he had an appointment with a patient. He came in, introduced himself, asked a few questions, and then said, my practice is to have the patient tell his story in all its detail into this wire recorder, and then I will pick up the transcription later on, take it home, and listen to it at my leisure and make some notes, and then I'll discuss the matter with you later. The patient nodded assent. The doctor went out and decided that he'd probably go downstairs to the drugstore in the lobby and get himself a chocolate soda, which he did. Very much surprised a couple of minutes later to see the patient come walking in. Climbed up on the stool beside him, and the physician turned to him and he said, say, I thought I left you talking to my wire recorder up my office. The patient said, yes, you did. You're the fifth psychiatrist that I've been to see. And I've told my story so often that I've put my story on a wire recorder and I've left my wire recorder talking to your wire recorder. Sure, you won't want to listen to what's on this wire recording when we get through. The topic which I should like to discuss today is training physicians for personal responsibility. It's a topic which has a very important connotation in the field of medicine, in the field of human relations. It has always been important, but I think today is perhaps more important than it has ever been, simply because the public is more concerned about the relationship of the physician to his patient than he has ever been before. Incidentally, I have some cards here, and if you're like I am, you make a mental note of each card as it's dropped off the top of the pile to kind of gauge how long this speech is going to be, and you begin to get a little relaxed as I get down to the last card or two. I want to assure you that that's the way I play this game. I take it off the top and put it on the table. There are some speakers, you know, who do this sort of thing, and then you never know where they are. There is a fortunately very rare group of speakers who not only does this sort of thing, but after having done this for an indeterminate length of time, does this sort of thing and starts all over again. But I promise you that I won't do that, and that I shall try to be finished at approximately 1:15, so that if you can't see the cards, don't worry. Now, I am not so wise that I can discuss this matter very authoritatively, nor yet am I so unwise that I fail to recognize the importance of this problem of personal responsibility. So I shall just try to give you some of my own ideas on the subject and beg your indulgence if it doesn't have the background that a longer experience than mine can give to it. The essence of the problem, I think, is simply this. How does a young man or a young woman who is untrained, who is non-professional, become transformed into a skilled and responsible physician? I think we need to ask ourselves first, what is a profession? Now, I'm sure that there are as many definitions of a profession as there are speakers who try to define it, but I like to think of a profession as having two major components. First component is that there be a rather well-defined body of technical knowledge and information. And secondly, that there be implied a sense of personal responsibility of the professional person toward the person to whom that knowledge and skill is directed. The professions vary. You might think of them as a spectrum. At one end, perhaps we would list the clergy, where the degree of technical knowledge and skill is relatively slight. A knowledge of the sacraments and a knowledge of the marriage ceremony, things of that sort. But the degree of personal responsibility is very high. It's characterized by the devotion of the preacher or the priest to his parishioner. And at the other end of the spectrum, you might think of the engineer, who has a very high degree of technical knowledge and skill. It's true that he has responsibility, but it's a responsibility which is a rather diffuse one, rather than a personal one. He's responsible in general for the welfare of the people who live in the buildings that he designs, or who drive their cars across the bridges that he has constructed. And right about halfway in between, partaking almost equally of these two components, one might place the physician. A large amount of technical knowledge and skill, and a high degree of personal responsibility for his patients. And I think that the medical profession has recognized its dual responsibility to these two ideals. Now, the young physician today finds himself in a rather confused situation. There are conflicting philosophies, which have nothing to do with the dichotomy that I have just presented to you. Problems of this kind. He gets his training in an academic environment, and in many cases he's impressed with the importance of learning, the importance of information, trained under teachers who sometimes think that the idea is the thing, and he may have a strong academic bent. His curiosity may be more significant than his understanding of the patient's welfare and the need of the patient for his services. Then, too, he has to practice his profession in an economic world. We have a situation developing increasingly every year where the proportion of the medical bill which goes to the physician is smaller and smaller, and that which goes to the laboratory for drugs, for hospitalization, is larger and larger. The total becomes larger and larger, and even though the physician's share of it is relatively small, he is charged in the mind of the patient with having caused the whole economic liability, and so the pressure is pretty directly on the physician with respect to these economic matters. It's true also that some of the very finest of the physicians are pushed into a place where they have to charge higher fees than they would like to, simply because they have no other way of keeping an unnecessary amount of work from coming to their office, work which they couldn't possibly do. So that the young doctor going out to practice today needs to have the devotion to these two ideals which I mentioned, namely the technical knowledge and skill, the devotion to his patient, and yet he is faced with these conflicting philosophies with respect to his practice. Now, how do we get our physician? All of you, I'm sure, are aware of the situation which exists, where there are many more people who wish to become physicians than the medical schools of the United States can train. And it's necessary for us in the United States of America to select our students. We're very pleased that we can select our students. In many of the European countries, South American countries, Mexico, anyone who can qualify for the basic matriculation is privileged to enter medical school. And you have the situation developing where 800-900 students enter the freshman class. It's almost impossible to provide materials for them to study with and to receive a good training. And the proportion of students who ultimately become physicians is very low indeed. Of that 1,000 who start, perhaps less than 25% will ultimately graduate. In this process of selecting our students, the medical schools have been accused of discrimination. And I think that there probably has been more unfair discrimination than we would like to see exist. But I would like to say that I have a very strong conviction that we need to discriminate in the selection of our students. Now, we have gotten so used to using that word with its modifying adjective, unfair, that we kind of think of discrimination as being unfair discrimination. I would like to say that I believe in fair discrimination. Now, why do we need to discriminate with respect to the selection of medical students? Of the students who enter the College of Medicine at the University of Illinois, approximately 90% will graduate and receive their MD degree. Of those who graduate, I think well over 99% will become licensed to practice. In other words, the medical school itself is not a selective process. The state board of medical examiners are not a selective process. The selection comes at the time that the student enters into medical school. Discrimination, in a very real sense, is related to discernment. And we need to discern those who are able. We need to discern those who have high ideals, which are consistent with the body of ethical concept that the medical profession has succeeded in identifying. We need to select those students who are well motivated, who are mature emotionally, or who have the potentialities for developing into a mature person. I think implicit in that selection is a recognition of the fact that at the age at which we get our students, which is around 20 to 24, there is very little plasticity left in the student with respect to his basic emotional patterns, his basic emotional attitudes. I'm sure that we can do a great deal in clarifying those things for the student, but we can't alter the basic process which has been begun during infancy and childhood, which has been worked upon by the grade school teacher, the high school teacher, by the university instructors.